Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. Joining me today is a veteran comic book writer and editor. He's best known for his work on Marvel titles such as X-Men, X-Force, New Warriors, Cable, Deadpool, Thunderbolts, among others. He's had some really definitive runs and stories at the publisher. He's helped create beloved characters like Deadpool, Domino, and of course, NFL Super Pro. He has his debut novel coming later this year from Penguin Random House, Suburban Dicks, and we're going to talk about that and Juggernaut and a whole lot more. So it's my pleasure to welcome back to the show Fabian Nicieza. Fabian, thanks for taking the time to join me.
My pleasure. It's good to be here. I just, for constant posterity, I have to say that I did not co-create NFL Super Pro. He was already created. I was just brought in to write it. So I wish that I could lay claim to that brilliance, but I cannot.
Okay, fair enough. I had to throw it in there just because, man, that is...
Because you're just trying to poke. You're trying to poke the bear is what you're trying to do. You're trying to get me started early in the afternoon before I've had my 3 o'clock cup of coffee.
You know what? It's one of those things that NFL Super Pro, he will stand the test of time. He will outlive us all.
I believe he will, to tell you the truth. He's like the cockroach of superheroes.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, I kind of wanted to start off before we get into Juggernaut and some of these other things you're working on. Suburban Dicks, I'm very interested in learning more about. But, you know, we've talked about, you know, the list of things, you know, and go on and on and on about all your different comics. But you're still writing comics. Do you feel like you have anything left to accomplish? I mean, you still enjoy doing it?
Yeah. You know, it honestly always depends on the individual assignment. And like with anything we've all done, any of us have done for a long time, there are going to be some days that are better than others. Mm-hmm. I still love the medium, and I still love the format, and I still love superheroes, but in a different way now. So it really depends on the assignment. Some of them are just jobs, to be, you know, just realistically blunt about it. But others are just fun, you know? So that varies. And a lot of that depends on the character you're working on, the editor you're working with, the artists you're working with. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that weigh into that. So it's not a blanket, you know, one statement covers all sort of a thing.
Right.
You know, there are some custom comics I did recently in the last 5 years for Marvel, which were just incredible pain in the ass assignments that I actually enjoyed tremendously because they were real challenges, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's other stuff that you could do where you just sort of shrug your shoulders and you go, okay. But you know, for the most part right now, I'm in a pretty fortunate position in that when I say yes, it's usually because I think it's going to be something I'm going to enjoy. And then I end up enjoying it. So, you know, Juggernaut or X-Men Legends and this other thing I'm working on right now for Marvel, which hasn't been announced yet, are things I can enjoy doing. So that's fun. And I enjoy doing Outrage on Webtoon, my digital comic with Riley Brown. I enjoy doing that a lot, even though the process of making it is a real pain in the ass. The actual content is tremendous fun to do.
Yeah, and I love that series. It's on my list to ask you about that as well, because that was the last time you're on the show with Riley to talk about Outrage.
Yep.
But let's start off with Juggernaut. You know, you're just talking about how you know, some of these assignments are just so fun. You take them on, and like you said, you're fortunate that you can kind of pick and choose. The big thing for me in the series, because I've never been a big Juggernaut fan, you made me care about Juggernaut. It was clear you were having fun on the series, and it was clear that you had a passion to tell this story about Kane Marco. So in your own words, if you were describing to some of our listeners who aren't familiar with this recent Juggernaut series that you did, how would you describe the series to somebody who's not familiar with it?
Good question. Haven't had to. It's so rare that I have to talk to anybody about comics who don't know everything about them already. I didn't think we sold to anybody who didn't already read comics. I would say that it's the story of a man who's always been perfectly content with being a runaway truck who would like to find a way to gain better control over the steering, the gas, and the brakes. Mm. And he's not 100% sure that he can or that he'll succeed, but he feels he's at a point in his life where he should probably try. And that in essence is me picking up from where they left him off in his last appearances in X-Men that was written by Matthew Rosenberg. And me picking him up from the last time I wrote him, which is almost 20 years ago, 18 years ago, whatever, in the X-Men Forever limited series, because it's the same exact thing I tried to bring to him back then too.
Right.
And as a result, I feel he's an interesting character in that, to me, the seminal issue for him that really made me change the way I looked at him as a reader and ultimately as a writer was Chris Claremont and John Romita Jr.'s Uncanny X-Men issue, where he ended up fighting, Juggernaut fought Colossus in a bar.
Mm-hmm.
But Colossus wasn't the instigator. All he wanted to do was sit and have a beer in a corner and then the X-Men show up, you know?
Right.
So to me, that was almost like the demarcation point where I started to think of him as a guy who's an incredible loser and really stupid, but doesn't necessarily think of himself as evil, you know?
Right.
And then you could use that as your template and justify and play with a lot of the instances that have appeared in the past where he has been an unrepentant asswipe and killer or whatever. And you could say that was Sidorak's influence on him, coloring him and shading him in worse ways than he may have been, although we know from his teenage years before he got the gem that he was already an ass. He was a jerk. He was a bully. He was a punk. And you know, so you just use that to your advantage because it's a guy who's no longer 18. So when you're in your 40s, which I'm assuming Kane Marco is roughly, you got to like ask yourself, how long am I going to be a bully? How long does that work for me? What am I gaining from that? Other people are advancing and moving beyond, including, you know, his best friend, Black Tom Cassidy. They're moving beyond where they were and he can't, you know, so mm-hmm. it's time for him to try to start doing that.
Now, was this a story that you always had thought of? You know, you mentioned, you know, previously when you worked on it, or was it Marvel that came to you and said, hey, we want to do a Juggernaut series. Are you interested?
Yeah, homie, don't pitch no more. I don't pitch ever. I wanted to do something with him back after X-Men Forever, and briefly talked to the editor, Mark Powers, way back then about, can we do a spinoff miniseries with Juggernaut in this new status quo as a bounty hunter for the Superhuman, you know, Registration Act?
Mm-hmm.
And it just never went anywhere. And within months, he was back to being, you know, whatever, Juggernaut, dumb Juggernaut. So I was like, shrug my shoulders, and that happens all the time in comics. You got to shrug your shoulders and you go, they're lost. This is how you got to approach it.
Right.
Now that this was a call out of the blue, completely out of the blue. Jordan White, the editor, called me up and said, would you be interested in doing a Juggernaut miniseries? And I said, pitching for a Juggernaut? And he goes, no, you'd be interested in doing one. And the minute he said that, I was like, I don't pitch, so I'm not going to go into a bake-off with other writers. I don't do that. I just don't do that anymore. I don't care, you know? And I knew what the status quo was. This is back in September of 2019, by the way. I knew what the status quo was because I'd read the Hickman Powers and House of X miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that he was not on the island, and at that time he wasn't going to be allowed on the island because no humans were going to be allowed on the island at that time. And I jumped at it immediately. I just said yes, because the idea of him without that support or without that foundation, without that, even that crutch, is interesting to me because I like him that way. So I said yes. And Jordan's pitch was basically, what's he going to do if he can't be a part of the X-Men? And I said, great. And then before Jordan hung up, as all smart editors do, he said, and his gem was ripped from his body and he was consigned to limbo last time we saw him. Click. And I'm like, wait, what? Because I'm not following the monthly books.
So
I realized, all right, I could ignore it. And he told me I could ignore it. And I just don't work that way. That's not the way my mind works. And that's not how I grew up reading comics. And a lot of present day writers may just ignore that previous last appearance, mm-hmm. but I can't. So I just decided to take that, use that to my advantage and make the story of his reacquisition of power to be an underlying thematic aspect to the whole miniseries, because the whole miniseries has flashbacks that are showing us what happened to him between when he got the gem ripped out of him and thrown into limbo and where he's at now at the beginning of the miniseries. I didn't want to make his reacquisition of the power to be the linear focus of the miniseries. I wanted that to be present day stories with him already having a new armor and stuff like that. But I wanted to show how he reacquired the armor and how he reacquired the power of Sidorak, considering that, you know, magic crushed the gem. She didn't just rip it out of his chest, right. She crushed it. So I wanted to play that to my advantage, because it did work really well for me, because the reason he needs power is just as a thematic statement in the book as the fact that he has power itself. So it became a dual narrative for me. Number one, why does Cain Marco need this power? And number two, what does Cain Marco do with this power? And both of those to me are thematic through lines that connect the miniseries from start to finish, because they are five self-contained issues basically that have those two things as their through line.
Yeah, and you know, like I was saying before, I had never really cared about the Juggernaut. He always seemed kind of boring to me. And it was that, what you're just talking about, him reacquiring the power, because for the first time, it's the Juggernaut. For the first time for me as a reader, it was, this is Cain Marco. And we always think about the Juggernaut as being unstoppable and thinking that's part of what Sidorak has given him through this gem. But when you see the journey that Cain takes himself on to reacquire that power, all of a sudden we realize it's Cain Marco who won't give up. It's Cain Marco himself who's unstoppable. That was my favorite idea of the whole series. So I think it worked really well. Did you hear from other readers that felt the same way?
I don't see letters anymore. All you usually get a snark on the internet, but I got very positive reviews overall for the whole series. I got very positive social media interaction. Nobody was tweeting, this sucks, you know? Mm-hmm. Nobody was tweeting, you suck. They were saying, this is really fun and I'm really enjoying it. And a lot of people were saying it's a hidden surprise. People aren't aware how good this is, that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I'm at the point in my career where I damn well better take all of that with a grain of salt. Because right. if I worry overly much about reviews or what people think about a book I do, I would probably not do anything, you know? You know what I mean? Right. So I want them to like it, but I'm not worried about whether an individual likes it or not. I'm more interested in the collective whole. And Marvel was very satisfied with it. The editorial was very satisfied with it. So that's all good. That's fine. You know, all good.
Yeah. And did you, you know, obviously you took some time to develop and you didn't want to throw out what had come before. Like you said, you wanted to pick him up right where he was. So did you settle right away on a tone and if so, did that lead to Ron Garney kind of being on the book? Because, you know, he really set a certain tone as well.
That's a great question. Ron was not initially the artist that was going to draw the series. I think Jordan had a couple other people in mind, but I think when Ron became available, he asked Ron if Ron wanted to do it. And Ron's also in a position in his career, as he should be, where he should work on the things he wants to work on. Mm-hmm. And they told him about the miniseries, and he liked the Juggernaut as a character because it's a fun character to draw. And he and I have known each other for 30 years. And he looked at the first two scripts, because I had done the first two scripts by that point. And he said, yeah, this is good. Let's do this. This is fun. And the minute he came on board, it didn't change the tone. It only helped kind of fortify it. It kind of helped cement the tone. I wasn't thinking of it with a gritty noirish tone to it, but that is how Ron is drawing now, and it works really well for every project he does. So it was going to work well for this one too. A lot of that also is how good Matt Miller is as a color artist, because Ron and Matt work really, really well together. Yep. And a colorist could really butcher the things Ron does with his art in terms of his grayscale layering of foreground, middle ground, background. Ron does a lot of heavy blacks and heavy silhouettes with a lot of gray knockouts of things. And it requires a very smart color artist to understand how to use color to turn that into depth.
Right.
And Matt's really good. So all of that added to the tone. I can't say one way or the other whether my writing changed once Ron came aboard, because I think I was already well into issue 3 before I even saw any art from issue 1. But like I said, it just fortified the approach. And I was trying to have very quick, fast-paced scenes. I was trying to have a self-contained story in each issue that was not a complicated story, because I didn't think Juggernaut stories need or should be complicated. It's really a point A to point D sort of a thing, and knock a few things over with B and C, you know? And I did know that I wanted several of the resolutions to be not physically based, but either emotionally or intellectually based. So issue 2 is not a physical resolution with the Hulk story. It's an emotional resolution, right, with the Hulk story. Issue 3 is an intellectual resolution on the part of Juggernaut, realizing how to make amends for the things he did wrong that led him into court to begin with. Stuff like that I was trying to do. You know, I wanted to get away from the punching something to solve something. And that within the context that Juggernaut should be rumbling through things, Juggernaut should be punching things, and Juggernaut should be creating tremendous amounts of George Perezian rubble. But I didn't want the stories themselves to be predicated on that as either your entry point or your conclusion.
Yeah, and like I said, I think it worked really well. The other thing that worked really well is the sidekick he has sort of during the series, D-Cell. In a way, he sees, you know, himself and her, doesn't want her to make the same mistakes. But he's also taking on this mentorship role, and he wants her to be safe. And in the end, he sort of sacrifices his friendship with her. They've grown very close. He sort of sacrifices his friendship with her because he wants what's best for her. And it really shows some growth in Kane Marco. So, you know, I applaud you for that. Is there anything that you want to kind of share with us about D-Cell? Was she part of the story right from the start?
Yeah, she was part of the story from the very initial breakdown I did. I did it for a few reasons. First and foremost, it's hard to write a solo character that does not have a built-in supporting cast. So you have to create a sounding board for that person, both through dialogue and through kind of like the emotional themes of the story. A sounding board helps in that regard. I did not want to have first person narrative, in which case I could have jettisoned a supporting character, because right. I have first person narrative to serve as my supporting character. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to do that because I didn't want Kane Marco to have first person narrative, because I didn't think that he would carry a depth of thought that would be worthy of exploring through first-person narrative. So my immediate thought, and Jordan jumped right on board and liked it a lot, was Arya and the Hound from Game of Thrones. That sort of a relationship.
Right.
And that's kind of how I tried to set it up, not to copy that relationship, but to use that template to serve the story. I wanted a character who was damaged but pretended she wasn't. I wanted a character because, you know, in some ways that's Kane also. I wanted a character whose powers are interesting and different and played well against against Kane himself and against the opponents they would be facing, and hers do, because I think it's a kind of a cool power set that I created for her. And ultimately, I wanted a character that was in denial as to her truth, because Kane is in a journey of accepting his truth.
Right.
You know, so by making her come to accept her truth, which she does by the fifth issue, he, in his own way, is coming to accept his truth. And his truth is, I have wasted my life for the wrong reasons and in pursuit of the wrong things. What can I do now to try to pursue the right things? you know? That doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a hero. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be proactively trying to fight bad guys or anything like that. You'll see if I get a chance to work on him again, what the right thing means for him. And then go from there, you know?
Yeah, it's
just because, yeah, and I've been told now that in the books, humans are allowed on Krakoa. They weren't when I originally wrote the miniseries, but because they are allowed on Krakoa, it's just a matter of time, I'm sure, before Kane has the opportunity to go there. But if it were up to me, I would say that he would reject an invitation to go because he doesn't want to be asked. He wants to earn it. So he would want to earn his place there, whether it's as a resident or as a visitor. He still would want to earn his way in.
Well, I hope Marvel's listening, because we definitely need more. I want more. And the way that it ended, you left it set up for more. But I wanted to follow up on something you said about Kane, you know, wanting to do the right thing, thinking he's wasted his life. So many times we hear stories of these fictional characters, and you know, even if they're a villain, but they're the saying is they're the hero of their own story. This is really Kane realizing he's not, and never has been, the hero of his own story, and trying to turn that around. Because I think it's so much more interesting when you give depth to villains. And I would make the argument, like you said earlier, that Kane hasn't been just a straight up mustache twirling villain for a long time. But my argument would be, you know, whether they start out as a villain or not, or wherever you want to put them on the hero villain scale, complex characters, characters we can relate to, characters with depth, are just so much more interesting to read. They must be so much more interesting to write. Is that
accurate? Yeah, by far. But you know, I got 75 issues of Thunderbolts under my belt, you know, so it's not like I don't have just a little bit of experience exploring the depth in what are perceived of as villains, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I like that a lot because of exactly what you said. It's just more interesting to write. It's more interesting to write a character who has failed more often than they've succeeded, but they keep trying, you know. Or they choose not to try. That's good too, you know. There's nothing wrong with that either,
right?
I like the opportunity to have a character look at themselves honestly in the mirror after they have not been for a very long time, and then once they've done that, try to follow their journey as they try to see what they're going to do about it. I just finished reading two trade paperbacks of the Bendis Maliev infamous Iron Man, or whatever it was called, and I thought it was one of the most interesting explorations of Victor Von Doom. And I've been reading Dr. Doom in comics since 1967. And it was such an interesting exploration of the character in this new place. Cause I think it was right after Secret Wars and right after he was no longer a god or whatever. Yeah. And I know Dan Slott used him in FF, and I don't even remember what that story really was detail wise. So I don't know where they went with it after, but that 12 issues I read was such a breath of fresh air to have this character look at himself in a new way, because he's always looked at himself one way, and so have everyone else, right? And now here he is seeing himself in a new way, but he can't convince other people to look at him. Which is completely understandable, by the way, but he's smart enough to even get that. And Bendis is a really good writer, so he's smart enough to understand that Doom is smart enough to understand why they don't give him that chance, you know? So it was fun. So things like doing that with Kane is really cool, just like it was doing it with the Thunderbolts the way I did, you know? It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, like I said, I finally saw Kane as relatable. I'm a Juggernaut fan now. I never really cared about the character before, and now it's like, yeah, the Juggernaut, he's cool. Like he's got something to him. It's not just that two-dimensional.
Yeah, and I want to see him having to lead this group of villains that he put together at the end. I want to see him having to be a boss, having to make decisions, having the responsibility to try to do the right thing. And I think that's a fun next step for him. But I would caution that however he's written afterwards, whoever writes him afterwards, it's not that he's a superhero now. It's not that he's a hero now. It's not that he's an anti-hero now. It's that he's trying to make the right choices for the kind of person he has been his whole life. Right. So those choices are not necessarily going to be legal. Sometimes those choices aren't going to be moral, but he feels that they're the right choice at any given moment, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's interesting to explore too.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing that you did recently, we'll sort of leave the juggernaut behind, X-Men Legends, number one with Brett Booth. Second issue comes out this month, March 31st. Why don't you kind of let everybody know what X-Men Legends is all about? Because it's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, X-Men Legends is stories set in past continuity that were never told. So that they are considered canon for continuity once they see print, but they take place in whatever given time frame that the creative personnel want to explore. And the idea was to hire the original creators of the different stories of those eras to tell new stories set in those eras. So for me, I get to tell the Adam X story, which I was never really able to tell back in the mid-90s. So it is as if I wrote the miniseries in 1995, like I had always originally planned to write the miniseries. So the only difference is that it's, you know, two issues instead of four issues. It's 50 pages instead of 88 pages. I was not as intrigued by the ideas you might assume, because that's not an era that I'm all that interested in revisiting. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that many stories that I want to tell from that time period. I have a lot of stories I didn't get to tell, but 25, 30 years later, I don't have that much of an interest in telling many of those stories anymore. But this is one that, for many reasons, obviously always stuck in my craw. Probably because I did such a poor job of introducing the character in his first few episodes, that the arc I had planned to take, which would have put it all into a greater perspective, never came to fruition. So the only perception of the character is at the beginning of the journey, when he was an idiot and an imbecile. You know, he was an idiot, he was over the top, he was excessive, but that had been part of my plan all along, and I didn't get to finish it, not even close to finishing, right? I barely even got to the halfway point, and you see at the halfway point where he is starting to grow up and come to terms with his reality. That was in the X-Men 39 issue, and that was in the Captain Marvel appearance. So that was taking us somewhere. I just never got to get us there. So it was an opportunity to kind of do justice to a character that both I didn't do justice to and editorial fiat didn't do justice to. And they let me tell the story. Zero. They had zero issues, qualms, problems. Mark Basso's the editor, and he was fantastic. He helped tremendously in helping to make sure that I found the connections to make up for the missing pages. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I had never written the miniseries, but I had rough notes that formed an outline to the miniseries. And I knew that I was going to be having to jettison a lot of pages from that. And he helped to find the smartest ways to bridge the gaps between those missing pages. You know, it's ironic, like, you won't know until issue two comes out, but there's a group of characters introduced in issue two that mark the point which would have been the third issue of the miniseries, and it's done in two pages instead of 22 pages. I just cut out an entire chunk of what was going to happen because it wasn't necessary to the very straightforward linear narrative that could be told, you know? I went into it not wanting to do it. I had tremendous trepidation about doing it. And as I'm scripting the first part of it, I said, boy, am I really freaking glad I'm getting to type these words out. I'm just glad that I'm getting it out of my system. Not that it was ever a cancer. It wasn't eating away at me. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't keeping me up at night. But for better or worse, the story is now told, and let it stand for what it is. And if you collect a trade paperback of all his previous appearances from the early 90s, which was only like five or six, and then add these two issues to it, you have your saga of Adam X, and you're okay. The Ballad of Adam X, the backwards cat boy, and you're done. And you don't ever have to think about him or worry about him again. But at the very least, you get a beginning, a middle, and an end. Whereas before, we never got that, you know?
Was it a challenge to kind of get yourself back in the mindset of the story you had planned on telling, other than kind of shortening it up? Were there any other changes that you made?
No. To be perfectly honest, the beginning and the end are exactly where it was going to be. The only things that changed was the middle, and that didn't even really change from the story beats standpoint. It changed from the amount of time I had to explore the story beats. So right. I just ended up having to cut out a lot of the good stuff, but a lot of the stuff that wasn't germane to the specific of the linear narrative. So in issue two, once Scott and Alex learn that Adam is their brother, and they start to learn the truth about how he came to be, they were going to have a lot more time to interact, right, you know, with each other. I don't have that time anymore. When Adam has to make a decision toward the end of issue two about what choices he has to make moving forward, it was going to be quite a bit more back and forth between all the characters regarding that choice. The choice gets made in a very, very, very clipped way, because it's happening off panel. The discussion and conversation happens off panel,
right,
that leads to the decision he has to make. So things like that. And you know, I'm sure when you read it, you're going to say that was abrupt, or that was clipped, or I wish we could have had more fleshing out of this or that. And that's fine. It's justifiable. But at the end of the day, I needed to get him to the end of the story. And if that meant cutting some of the character interaction, then that's what was going to have to go to get him there. I did not want to end in a non-conclusive manner. So I just decided to end the story the way I wanted to end the story way back then.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably not a chance to go back again 25 more years and it'll be like X-Men Legends.
I'll be almost 85 years old enough if I'm still doing X-Men Legends when I'm 85 years old, put a bullet through my head.
The other thing that's great about it, when we talk about revisiting this era, is you got Brett Booth as your artist. You know, he's really channeling that 90s style. Was he somebody you had in mind, or was that somebody from Marvel, Jordan, or whoever? No, that was me.
And the original artist for the miniseries was going to be Jeff Johnson, who had been drawing Wonder Man for me as an editor. Mm-hmm. And it's just that Jeff's art style right now, I don't know if it would have been conducive to the story that was being told in this issue, but I also don't think Jeff's art style now is conducive to the feel that editorial wanted for the book.
Right.
You know, they want it to feel like it's of the era that it's being told in. And I honestly, as I started scripting, I had no one else in mind but Brett. I wanted Brett to draw it. He's done enough pinups and things like that, commission art of the X-Men. I knew how much he loved Cyclops. To me, Brett is sort of like Gil Kane meets Art Adams meets Jim Lee. And all three of those are perfect, both for the Adam X character's visualization and how he moves and the era of the time, you know? So, I was writing it with Brett in mind without knowing whether he'd be drawing it or not. And I asked for him, and Marvel said, oh, you know, we just started using him on some X stuff. So let's see. And they asked Brett if he wanted to do it. And Brett said, yes, absolutely. And that was it. And I don't know Brett personally. I never met him before. I just think his art is just right for this kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. Well, let's talk a little prose now. As I mentioned, you have your debut novel coming out. Yay! from Penguin Random House, Suburban Dicks, scheduled to be released on June 22nd of this year. So before we talk about making that transition, why don't you tell everybody what the story's about?
It's my pinned tweet. So go on Twitter and go look at my pinned tweet. The story is about a woman who should have been an FBI profiler, but she's pregnant with her fifth child and she's only 33. Okay. And a 29-year-old reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize when he was in college for journalism. And now at 29, he works for a weekly suburban newspaper. So it's about two people who should have been and never were. And they hook up, they partner up. I shouldn't say hook up because that is the wrong connotation. They partner up to solve a crime that occurs in their suburban New Jersey town. A gas station attendant was killed. The police say robbery. She suspects otherwise. And what she suspects starts taking a pretty kooky turn, and it ends up revealing a 50-year-old mystery that has become a generational cover-up for the police department and the government, the administrative government of the township. And they just step, but they little by little, they start to uncover the secret of the past mystery is what will reveal the killer in the present, you know, the gas station attendant. So it's really a story about two people rediscovering who they should be and giving each of them, giving themselves a chance to become the more of the person they should be. Just as importantly, it's thematically a story about the suburban fear of change and fear of the differences in our cultural demographics in the suburbs over the course of time. I've lived in the same area of New Jersey for 30 plus years, so I've really watched the cultural demographic change in the area I live in. It is now like 60-70% Asian, Indian, Chinese, Korean, Pakistani, and it was only maybe 30% that back in the late 80s, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had the book idea back in 94, so it took me quite a while to decide to write it. I had the title, the characters, the beginning, the middle, and the end pretty much worked out real solidly back in around 94 and 95. And I started writing it for real in 2017. So I'm glad I waited for many reasons, not the least of which it gave me a better perspective on a lot of the thematic underpinnings that I wanted to bring to the book. So I see it as an entertaining, fast-paced, funny, breezy murder mystery, but it's got some food for thought and some crunchy granola sort of thematic points of view that hopefully make you question and see certain things around you a little differently.
Now, you know, writing prose is so much different than you know, writing comics, of which you've, you know, written hundreds and hundreds. You don't have the visual aspect. Is it something that you really enjoyed, the process, and do you hope to do more?
Yeah, well, I hated the process anytime I tried it in the past, because I thought it sucked. Mm-hmm. So I had written a lot in prose, and I chucked it. I had even been hired to write a prose novel in the early aughts, by Byron Price Books, for a Marvel licensed novel, which was going to be a Gambit novel. And I had over 250, I think I had 270 pages of it written, and Marvel canceled the contract with Byron Price. So they pulled the plug on a bunch of books. Mine was one of them. I haven't looked at that pros in 20 years. So I have a gut feeling I'm really glad that it got canceled. I'm really glad that I don't know that I would have ever been able to do it until I did it now. And it could be because I had no F's left to give, you know what I mean? It didn't matter. It's something I felt I wanted to do, not thinking it would be a monetary accomplishment. I just wanted to finally be able to finish one. And I had a lot of help along the way because I had people reading it and giving me advice. I hired an editor when I finished the manuscript to give me advice on cutting because I had to cut. I had to cut a lot. I cut a lot, and that was bad writing. I cut a lot of things that I repeated because I hadn't written in prose before. So it's very different when you're working in comics in shorter chunks with, you know, sequential publishing over the course of a month than it is to write a singular long form tale.
Right.
The comics experience did help me tremendously in pacing and structuring my chapters. So they don't drag. They're fast. They're quick. I mean, they're not fast like a James Patterson chapter, which is three pages, but they're like 8 to 12 page chapters. And I also was very good, I think, about ending most chapters at a point where it makes you want to read the next
one.
You know, it ends not necessarily on a cliffhanger, but on a note that makes you curious about what's going to happen next. Mm. And the other way comics helped me tremendously was with my dialogue. I'm a little bit coy. John Lennon one time in an interview about the Beatles said that Paul was always a little bit coy about what an excellent bass player he was. And I've always been a little bit coy about my comfort in writing dialogue. So it really benefited me writing the book in that I could write facile dialogue that could be fast-paced if necessary, slow down and be smart if necessary. And each character had their own voice. And that helps a book tremendously because it keeps you engaged with the characters. And the response I've gotten from the many people now who have read the book is that the characters are a tremendously strong selling point for the novel. It's one of the main reasons why the publishers wanted to get it is because they thought the characters were really interesting. And I was really happy about that because I'd had the templates for the characters for 25 plus years. So I'm glad that in the meantime, no one else has written a book about a 33-year-old pregnant should have been FBI profiler. And that helped a lot too. It's a lot of stuff that's out of my wheelhouse. I'm not a mystery writer. I it's a 2-book contract, and I just finished the second one and delivered it a couple of weeks ago. That's also a mystery, a murder mystery. But I don't consider myself a murder mystery writer. To me, the murder and the mystery is just what propels the narrative forward. And the book is about something. And in this particular case, the book is about suburban fear of change and white cultural fear of change. It's an underlying subtext throughout the whole thing. Kenny, the reporter is Kenny Lee, and he's Asian American, born in this country, as were, you know, his parents. And the other lead character is Andrea Stern, and she's 34-year-old Queens Jewish city girl who's been living in the suburbs since she was in middle school. But then went back to college in Columbia in the city. So concrete under her feet is real living, and she's been out in the suburbs for more than half her life, you know? I want to say it's out of my wheelhouse, but it's actually not, because it's been in my head for so long, you know, that it felt very, once I got to a certain point, I felt like there was no way I can't finish this. You know, there's been other times I've gotten as far as not counting the Gambit novel, which was, you know, the plug was pulled, so I had no control over that. I would have finished that one, even though I probably would have hated it. I'd gotten as far as like page 100 on previous prose things, and just trashed it because I just thought it was bad. And then this time I was reading it and I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, you know, this isn't that bad. What's going on here? I've had a few other people reading it as I go along, and they're telling me it's not that bad. So, okay, it's not that bad. I honestly didn't know that I'd be able to sell it. I didn't know that I'd get an agent. I certainly didn't think that I'd have multiple publishers wanting to buy it. That was really just a fun, unexpected roller coaster ride. But I'm at the point now, because it's been a few years, where I'm a little bit cocky in my confidence for the second book. it was so much easier to write the second book than the first book. Because, you know, I mean, I've been a professional writer for 35 years. If I don't know how to figure stuff out, then I'm in big trouble by this point, aren't I?
Right, you know? Right, yep.
And I figured, I feel I cracked it once, and now it's the process, you know?
Right.
It's not a mystery anymore. I understand the process. I understand how much is going to fit in a given chapter, how much is dragging it out a little too long, how not to repeat things that the audience may know, the reader may know, but another character may not know. That was my big mistake when I had to cut the first book, is because as things get revealed, the audience already knows it, but character A, who learned at the same time as the audience did, has to relay all this to character B,
right,
20 pages later. But you can't do that because the audience already knows it. So why bother? Right.
Right.
And I had that's a lot of what I cut out, because I didn't know any better. I fell into that trap. And the trap I fell into in the second book was really fascinating, because I have a group of local readers who have agreed to read. They read the first manuscript, and several of them agreed to read the second manuscript. They're basically my cultural police, because I want to make sure that I'm not. I tell them up front, my goal is to offend everyone with equal opportunity,
right.
But I don't want to offend any one group, you know.
Right.
So I ask them to read it to make sure that I'm not offending any one group. Because it's a sarcastic suburban mystery. That's why I call it. I mean, the narrative voice is snarky, and it deals with race, and it deals with, you know, prejudice and stuff like that. That they read the second book, and one of the readers was great, because she had not read the first book. I had a few different people involved, and I wanted at least one person who had not read the first book, because it's a series. It's the same characters
coming
back for another mystery. And she told me that she doesn't know if she needs to read the first book now, because I revealed so much of what happened in the first book through the natural course of interaction of the characters in the second book.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even think of that. I was like, wait a minute, you can't give away the secrets of the mystery to the first book in the second book, because oftentimes in a series, people don't pick up the first book. They don't pick up a series until maybe the fourth or fifth book, you know?
Right.
Especially if this thing ends up on TV, which it might, then that'll really make a difference, because when people watch it on TV is when they're going to go back to read the books, you know? And that could be 5 years from now. So I went back into the manuscript before delivering it to the editor, and I just basically cut or reworded a lot of that so that I'm not giving away who the killer was in the first book. And I'm like, duh, I didn't even think of that, you know? So that's, yet again, that's a lesson. Now I won't repeat that mistake in the third book. I'll come up with a new mistake, of course, but I won't repeat that one, you know?
Well, as long as you're moving forward.
My opinion has always been, as long as you find new mistakes to make, then you're growing as a writer.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, if I can do this, it was a 2-book contract. I've handed in the second manuscript. There's no guarantees they're going to want to renegotiate the contract or renew the contract. There's no renewal clause. They can offer me more books. I own the copyright. So if I really want to, I could take the entire premise to another publisher if I want. I'm in a place I hate being in, which is a nebulous, I don't know what's next place.
Mm-hmm.
I want to keep writing books because I really enjoyed writing these two. I want them to succeed because I'd like to be able to continue doing it.
Right.
I just feel like It's a great closing chapter to my career is what it amounts to. I'm turning 60 this year. I got 10 to 15 years left of avid work interest, you know, of engaging with work on a real committed level. I figure I got 10 to 15 years left. It's 15, so let's say 10. so if I can do, you know, if I can do 5 books in a Suburban Dicks mystery series and maybe a spinoff, that, you know, I'd be pretty freaking great way to close it all out, you know. And if TV happens and I get an opportunity to write an episode, that would also be great, because I always wanted to write for TV, but I never wanted to live out in LA, which was right. Such a prerequisite, you know. So if I get to write a TV episode of the adaptation of the book, that's another. If I get to do that when I'm 63 or whatever, that's
great. Yeah, you know? bucket list thing. Well, it's got to be challenging too, because we know in the prose stuff, the timeline is so much longer. And you're used to, you know, that constant deadline of monthly series. So like you said, I imagine that the kind of waiting, because I mean, from their perspective, they're probably, well, let's see how the first book does.
Absolutely. And to their, yeah. And I understand, you know, these are not cheap contracts. These are, yeah. You know, this was a nice chunk of change that basically paid me for a year's worth of my normal juggling of 4 or 5 things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I got to do the book. That was it, you know? So it's not little. I'm not in any way, shape or form dismissing the responsibilities of the company, because I've been a company guy so often that I understand it. But the lead time does make it really annoying based on my experiences.
Right, exactly.
I got the call to do X-Men Legends like in September, and here we are in February with the first issue coming out.
Yeah,
and the second issue is late too, so go for, you know, of course leave it to Marvel to have a story 25 years waiting to be told where it's late. Already it's late before we even started. I'm like, come on, you gotta be kidding me. Only comics could do that.
So
to me, the book is so weird because I sold it in November of 2019 to Putnam, and the copy edited manuscripts were all kind of checked through little by little, step by step, all through 2020. Like the final copy edited manuscript, my final edits on the manuscript were done mid-December of 2020. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's still not coming out until June of 2021.
Yeah,
and the second book. The second book doesn't even have a pub date yet. The assumption is it'll be approximately a year after the first one comes out. So I'm assuming it would be between June and August of next year.
Right.
But I don't know. It might be winter. It might be Christmas time. I don't know. Yeah. You know, it's very weird because I don't think that way. I think long terms in terms of the characters. Mm-hmm. I don't think long term in terms of the release of the material.
Yeah, the publishing date.
And by the time the book comes out and we start getting reviews and all that stuff, it's going to be like, how long ago did I do this?
Yeah, wait, what happens in this story?
You're criticizing something I wrote 2.5 years ago. Leave me alone. That's like an eternity for a comic book writer. You're not going to consider complaining about a comic I wrote 2.5 years ago. Forget about it. It's in the past, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So it is fascinating in that regard, you know, it really is. I guess TV is just as weird because although the cycle of production on a season of something is relatively compressed, the set between optioning it and hiring a showrunner and working with the showrunner and having a pilot script and having the platform casting, or the network approve it, and then casting and that's a year sometimes or longer. So mm-hmm. you know, we optioned this for TV development last year, but the optioning process started before the book even sold. At the same exact time, I had TV people interested in it, and my agents were doing both. So when, like the week I was talking to different publishers who wanted to buy it, I also was talking to different TV producers who wanted to option it, juggling that back and forth. And it was It was ridiculously crazy. Cool. I'm not gonna deny that, but it was also kind of weird because none of it was real yet. It was just a manuscript.
Right. Yeah.
They were willing to option the book for TV development before the book had even come out. Way before the book had even come out, a year and a half before the book had even come out. So that was interesting to me. And yet the optioning process took so long, the contract negotiation took so long, finding a showrunner takes so long that lead time is already gone. So, the book will come out way before we even know if there actually will even be a TV show.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah, those timelines that get, development, it's crazy. And I've talked to a lot of comic creators that feel the same way. It's just you get a concept, 2 months later, you can have the book out. It doesn't work like that in a lot of other mediums. But congrats, man. Congrats on debut novel. It's going to come. It must, I just think as a creator, to have these characters that have lived in your head so long, they're finally going to be out there for the world to meet. I just think that's really cool. So.
Yeah, and it's really ironic in a way that everything we were talking about with Adam X and the X-Men Legends thing is that I'm writing these lines that I had in my brain in 1995, and it ends exactly the way I planned for it to end in 1995. And Suburban Dicks is the same way. I had the last line of the book in 1994, 1995. And when I wrote the last line of the book in 2000, or I think it was like December of 2018 or January of 2019. When I wrote that last line, it felt like the completion of a journey when it was really just the beginning of one. Which is so odd. And I had the last line of the second book in my head a long time ago too. Not as early as the first book, but I knew what the last line of the second book was going to be. I know what the last line of the third book is going to be if we get a third book. You know what I mean? So it does. This stuff lives in your head, and sometimes to the detriment of your work, but then you get a payoff like that, and it's sort of like, oh, that's pretty freaking cool.
Even if it is whatever 35 years later, almost, that's crazy.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, at least for me in this case, it didn't diminish the feeling of accomplishment, I'm not going to say that the time it took to do it enhanced that feeling of accomplishment one way or the other,
Right.
I just know that when I was done typing the words, I just felt that's one less thing that's going to bug me in my brain.
Right. That's one
less moth flitting about in my brain, exactly. Which is a very important thing to get out of your head if you can. Why I like writing Deadpool. I don't get to write them nearly enough, but I always like writing Deadpool because it got a lot of moths out of my head. When I got to write a monthly, I was probably my most mental health I had is when I got to write Deadpool monthly, because every month all this crap you're just throwing coming out of me.
you're taking out the trash. That's great. as we're winding up here, Fabian, I did want to bring up, like I said earlier, Outrage, your webtoon that you do with Riley Brown, and you mentioned how much fun you have doing it. Do you want to let everybody know, remind everybody, and I encourage you listeners, if you haven't listened to our interview with Fabian and Riley, go back and look for it. It's still available. It's a great chat about the series in depth, but just remind everybody what Outrage is about.
Outrage is a digital comic that appears on Webtoon, which is the leading digital comic producer in the globe. It's a vertical scroll comic. Outrage is the story of a digital construct that comes through your social media device and smacks you around if you're being an ass on social media. So he is the bully who bullies the bullies on the internet. And the first season of Outrage, which was 26 chapters long, was discovering what is Outrage, how did it come about, and who was behind it. The second season has really been about what happens if the mentality of Outrage manifests itself in the real world. What if people start to assume the rights of being outraged and think that it's okay to express yourself the way Outridge was expressing himself against the people who were expressing themselves inappropriately, you know? Right. So it really is this whole circle jerk about what a completely screwed up society we are, and how deeply, deeply flawed the human race is. All of it as seen through the faceplate of a digital construct. And Outridge is a hard light digital construct, but he is sentient. He was born of, I don't want to give away the first season, but he was born of a template of human thought and mentality and opinion, but he has his own thoughts now. And he does identify as he, even though he really doesn't know if he has any internal genitalia or external genitalia. Yeah. And season two is being released on a weekly basis now on Webtoon. I will say, unfortunately, we have to go on a short hiatus because our schedule completely crumbled. So it's about 6 pages of material that gets released on a weekly basis. And we could not keep up with the schedule in order to have the remaining 10 or 14 chapters of the season come out as necessary. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take probably about a 6 to 8 week hiatus while we catch up. So the last chapter that dropped last week, I think, was 42. Yep. And I think 43 is dropping tomorrow. I'm not 100% sure if they're going to drop 44 yet. It's complicated because they have something called Fast Pass where you can pay to read 3 chapters in advance. And people paid to do that, but they're no longer offering Fast Pass the minute we couldn't give them 3 in advance. Right. So maybe chapter 44 next week is the last one to drop before our hiatus. Don't hold me to it one way or the other. There'll be a placard appearing on the site saying, "We're sorry, apologies, but this is what's going on." And we'll be back probably in May with the remaining 10 to 14 chapters of the season coming out regularly the way they should. And hopefully during the hiatus, we may drop 1 or 2 fun mini chapters your way just to keep a little bit of Outridge in your heart and soul. the book, most people subscribe to their content on Webtoon, so you get a notification if you've subscribed to a title. So we have a couple 100,000 subscribers and they'll know when a new chapter drops, but we want to give those subscribers a little bit of content during the hiatus, just so that they don't forget us.
Yeah. And so listeners, Fabian said, the last chapter came out on March 2nd. So the new chapter is actually coming out. He said tomorrow, but it's today as you're listening to this, because this is coming out on the 9th. So yeah,
chapter. I'm so confused.
Yeah, but yeah, that whole timey-wimey recording ahead of time thing. But yeah, so chapter 43 on the 9th. And it's perfect. If you haven't heard of Outridge, it's hilarious. It's so fun and it's relevant, and we can all kind of relate to it because we all get mad at the internet sometimes and social media and what have you. So if you haven't checked it out, go check it out. And the hiatus is going to allow you to get caught up.
Yes, that's actually a great point. What a great rationalization.
I've been doing this a while.
our inability to meet our schedule gives you the audience a chance to catch up.
Yeah, that's right.
And I really Hollywood pitch it, elevator pitch it for as bluntly as possible. It's not Deadpool, but it's Deadpool-ish. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think the two characters are the same, but certainly some of their sensibilities and the way they vocalize those sensibilities are the same, because the words are coming out of the mouth, the fingertips of the same writer.
Yeah, exactly. If you love the fact that Deadpool has no filter, you're going to love the fact that Outridge has no filter too.
Yeah. I do think they're different characters, though. I think that their filters, that what's coming through those filters are different.
It's different.
Because Outridge really does have much more of a modus operandi and a mm-hmm. purpose than Deadpool does.
Yeah. The zaniness is not there, but it's, they tell it like it is, but in different ways.
Yeah. So hopefully go check it out, because it is free to read on Webtoon. You can read the entire first season and you can read all of the second season for free on Webtoon. And Webtoon has a lot of great content on it, not just Outridge. There's a lot of really good books, and there are more people globally reading comics on Webtoon than anything Marvel and DC publishes, probably times 10,
easily,
if not more. So check it out, because there's a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah. And listeners, I'll put a link in the show notes to Webtoon, to the Outrage page, so you can go and check it out there. And I'll also put a link to your social media, Fabian. If anybody wants to follow you online to find out when things are coming out, you know, a reminder of when Suburban Dicks is coming out, when you have comic work coming out, where's the best place to follow your work?
Right now, the best place is probably Twitter, and that's at Fabian Yciesa. I will have my website probably up by May-ish. So I'm going to have an author website. I have to. I was told I have to for the release of the book. So I always avoided it like the plague because it just sounded like too much work to me. But I'm going to have an author website up by May, which it will be at FabianNiciessa.com. It's up to you to spell it right, not me. And that'll have information about the book and any upcoming releases. If I build a website little by little, I'll probably have an entire comic section there with a whole bunch of stuff as well. But initially, the website will really be for the promotion of the book, and that'll be up in May.
Great. So a link to Fabian's Twitter and a link to Outrage, like I mentioned, in the show notes, everybody. So if you're having trouble finding them, you can go and click there. Fabian, we always love having you, man. We look forward to the next time you're going to come on. Thanks for talking Juggernaut with us and X-Men Legends. And again, congratulations on your debut novel. Can't wait to check it out. It sounds like a whole heck of a lot of fun.
Thank you, everyone. Pre-order today. I was told pre-orders really matter.
Oh, they do.
So
yeah, they definitely
if you
do.
Want me to write a third and fourth book, you got to pre-order this one. No pressure, everybody, but please do. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Great show again.
Yep. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We appreciate your support as always, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.